Russia has begun a renewed offensive in eastern Ukraine. Many are calling it the battle for Donbas. But what does this new phase mean for the larger conflict? And what is the human cost? This is Inside Story. Hello, welcome to the program. I'm Kim Vinell. It's been nearly 2 months since Russian forces invaded neighboring Ukraine. The conflict has killed countless civilians and displaced millions. Now, Moscow says it's shifting its focus to the east, where it's increased its assault in the Donbas region. The US, British and Canadian leaders have promised to send more weapons to Ukrainian forces. Many say this is a crucial stage of the conflict and could lead to the breakup of Ukraine. We'll get to our guests in just a moment, but first, this update from Asad Beg.
What Russia refuses to call a war has now entered its second phase, and it's being dubbed the Battle for Donbas.
This operation in the east of Ukraine is aimed, as was announced from the very beginning, to fully liberate the Donetsk and Luhansk republics. And this operation will continue. It is beginning, another stage of this operation is beginning, and I'm sure this will be a very important moment of this entire special operation.
Ukrainians caught up in the fighting are forced to flee as Russian forces pummel cities and towns. Ukraine's president says Russia will not be successful.
The intensity of fire by Russian troops in the Kharkiv direction, in the Donbas and in the Dnipropetrovsk region has increased significantly. The same as before, they consider ordinary residential housing to be normal military targets. In this war, the Russian army will forever inscribe itself in world history as perhaps the most barbaric and inhumane army in the world.
Ukraine says it's repelled a number of Russian attacks in the east. A second ultimatum issued by Russia for Ukrainian soldiers in Mariupol to surrender has passed. Moscow had said the lives of the soldiers inside the steelworks would be spared if they ceased what it called senseless resistance.
The United States and Western countries are doing everything to drag out the special military operation as much as possible. The growing supplies of foreign weapons clearly signal their intention to provoke the Kyiv regime to keep fighting until the last Ukrainian.
The European Union is considering more sanctions on Russia.
We call on Russia, we continue to call on Russia to stop all the illegal and illegitimate actions connected to its aggression against Ukraine. And when it comes to next round of the sanctions, I think the EU highest representatives, the leaders of the EU and also the representatives of the member states were very clear that we continue the work on further sanctions, and when the time will be right, they will be announced.
So far, calls for a ceasefire or the threat of sanctions have not stopped this war. And although Russia may have failed to take Kyiv, the battle for the East is one Russia cannot be seen to lose. Asad Beg, Al Jazeera.
All right, let's bring in our guests in Kyiv. We have Halina Yachenko, a member of the Ukrainian Parliament and Secretary of the National Presidential Council in Moscow. Pavel Falkenhauer, defense and military analyst for Novaya Gazeta, an independent newspaper. And in Brussels, Teresa Fallon, director of the Center for Russia, Europe, Asia Studies. Thank you very much for joining us here on Inside Story. I'd like to start with you, Pavel Falkenhauer, if I may, as the military analyst. What does this new stage in the war, what does it mean?
Well, it's a change of emphasis. It's Russia tried in the beginning of this campaign to kind of advance at the same time on a number of different separate directions. It didn't work out very well. So now Russia's reserves and forces, which are clearly not adequate for such a job of moving in all directions, will be concentrating in the particular area of the east-south Ukraine to achieve apparently victory there. So now they began what we officially announced, at least by the Russian foreign minister, as a new stage.
I've heard it described as a do-over. I don't know if you're familiar with that, but where you fail the first time, you try again a second time. Is that what this is? Failure of the initial aims, therefore a recalibration, a new kind of measure of what success means for Russia in this war?
Well, in the first week, more or less, of the campaign, in the south, Russia achieved quite a lot. The forces broke out of Crimea, moved swiftly in different directions, captured a number of Ukrainian big cities without much resistance or with no resistance at all, across the Dnieper, captured a bridge over the Dnieper, rather spectacular, but then that advance kind of came to a halt, not enough reserves. And now the commander who was in charge of this initial success in the south, General Alexander Dvornikov, the commander of the South Military District, has become the CNC of the whole operation. He's given more freedom, more reserves, and since he's kind of the general of the month, from the Russian point of view, who achieved most successes, it's called on him to kind of achieve success of the entire operation. And, well, we'll see what he's going to do. But, of course, right now it's a very slow start for the second stage. It's, I would say, preliminary action and very slow action.
All right, let's talk about what Russia is going to do. Helena Yatchenko, you're a member of the Ukrainian parliament. You're in Kiev. You're Ukrainian. What do you think that Russia's President Putin wants with Donbas?
Well, first of all, I want to respond on a lie and Russian propaganda that you just heard from the man before. First, there is no operation, and don't call it operation, because it's war, it's massive execution of civilians who have nothing to do, you know, with military guys. If you want to call torturing children an operation, if you are calling these kind of things an operation, then I'm really sorry for you, because, you know, there is something wrong with your head and with your moral qualities. So this is war. This is massive execution of civilians. This is torturing of children. This is raping women. And no one in this world, no one who has heart and who has mind in his head, don't call it operation. It's a war. And it's a very bad thing that Russian occupants, that Russian Nazis are doing in Ukraine. And the situation is very tense. Just yesterday, I have reported on my Twitter that the situation in Mariupol is very tense. There are still a number of civilians. We are talking mainly about women and children. And in my opinion, as mother of two children, there is no way that Russian soldiers can shelling children. Mm-hmm. There are a lot of children, a lot of mothers with newborn babies in Mariupol hiding in bomb shells of Azovstal. Mm-hmm. And we hear that Russian soldiers have orders to shell these people. So Russians have an order to shell children.
Okay.
I am currently talking to all Arabic mothers and all Arabic, you know, people who are watching our show. Do you consider that it is okay to shell and to murder children? Do you imagine that your children or you yourself will go through this kind of nightmare? This is what Ukraine is going through.
I know that the mayor of Mariupol has said some 20,000 civilians have been killed in Mariupol. It hasn't been verified, but that is a shocking number. I need to move over to Brussels, if I may. Theresa Fallon, what do you think that President Putin wants with Donbas? And what do you make of, I know the European Council President Charles Michel is in Kyiv today. What do you make of Europe's response so far?
Well, it appears that instead of working all across Ukraine, they want to focus on Donbas to have some sort of a success story. But even many analysts think that with the May 9th deadline, some people think that because of the May 9th victory day deadline, that they want to serve up some sort of positive story for Russia, because most analysts have been rather shocked and surprised at how long this has taken Russia. So people have overestimated the Russian military. It has been acting very chaotically, and now they can just focus on Donbas. But of course, the Ukrainians have a great deal of experience there. They've been at war for 8 years. And as you noted, Charles Michel, the president of the European Council, is visiting Kiev today, signaling Europe's interest in the region. But the whole issue about sanctions is kind of symbolic in many respects. Some sanctions do have teeth. We're seeing that the Russian economy is really taking a hit. But the key issue is energy. And for example, Germany is almost half reliant on their supplies from Russia. So I think that the fact that they're still not talking about gas doesn't show that they're very serious about that, because they're worried about the inflationary pressures in Europe. In addition to that, individual member states can cut reliance on Russian gas, as we've seen with Lithuania, which now has zero imports of Russian gas. So they don't need all for the whole EU with 27 member states. It's very difficult to get everyone to agree. You have some countries like Hungary who are more pro-Russian than other countries, so it would be difficult for them to all work together. They might water down the sanctions. But then there are other types of symbolic sanctions, like on caviar, which is just a small, small portion of exports to Europe. So I think that the Europeans, they do a lot of virtue signaling, but I think that there is a growing wariness about what's really happening in Ukraine. We've seen millions of refugees flee to Europe. And as the other commentator noted, this is a very serious war. And we're also seeing other effects, unintended consequences of Putin's behavior. For example, both Sweden and Finland are looking like they will join NATO.
Yeah, we're going to talk about that. We're going to talk about those moves towards joining NATO a little bit later, and what that might mean for security calculations in Europe. I'd like to come back to you, Pavel Falkenhauer, because I don't think we've really answered this question yet. What is the significance of the Donbas region for President Putin?
Well, Russia has been supporting the pro-Russian separatists there in Donetsk and Lugansk since 2014. Before this campaign began, Russia recognized officially the independence of these two statelets. And actually, the official reason for going into Ukraine has been the need to defend them and expand their territory to the administrative pre-war territories of the Lugansk and Donetsk oblast. So now they're trying to do that, apparently. But again, there's this talk about the May 9 deadline. I don't believe that there is a deadline. It's not. There is no deadline at all. The thing is that Russia is caught in a very serious situation and will try to do its best to break out of it. But May 9 does not play much of a role. There's going to be a parade in Moscow, and okay, but that's it. Right now, Russia and Ukraine are in a mid-season situation. The winter campaign is over. The summer campaign did not begin. The ground is still a bit wet. There was a lot of rain. So right now, actually, the advances will be very slow by definition, because you have to still rely on paved roads, which in the Donbas are very narrow, not many of them, in a very bad state. So both sides are preparing for decisive battle in the summer campaign.
Okay, all right.
And that's right now what they'll be jockeying for positions, who's going to occupy the better position for the decisive battle, which I begin that will happen in May, maybe in June.
Helena Yatchenko, talking about the East, about Donbas, it's been almost 8 years since they self-declared themselves as republics. It's been described since then as becoming totalitarian.
No, it's not true. It's like.
Right, okay.
It's like.
Will you give me your perspective
then,
please?
Once again, these people were going to referendum with being forced by Russian soldiers who came to our land, who came to a sovereign country, which Ukraine is and was in 2014, and they forced people to go to fake referendum. So please don't use Putin narrative, don't use narrative of Russian Nazis, and don't say that Ukrainian territory claimed themselves to be, you know, Russian territories or independent territories.
I called them self-declared. Self-declared.
They are not self-declared.
Right.
They are not self-declared.
Okay, right.
They are terrorists and separatists.
Right.
So please don't use Russian narrative, because I hope that you are independent media and no Kremlin media or Russian media, right?
What I want to tell you is that
the guy, the Russian guy who just talked, was talking about, you know, a kind of winter campaign, summer campaign, but he forgot to mention that there is spring campaign. It's a planting campaign, a campaign when Ukrainian farmers, when Ukrainian agriculture companies are planting food which will grow in summer and autumn. And I want to tell you, I want actually to finally knock to your heart and your minds with information that what Russians are doing in Ukraine is atrocity, but not only to Ukrainian people, to Ukrainian mothers, Ukrainian children, but also they are doing horrible things to all Arabic world.
Okay,
and I will explain.
Sure. No, I hear what you're saying.
No, please.
No, excuse me. My role in moderating is to ensure that we have an even conversation where all panelists have the opportunity
show,
to share the same amount of airtime. So I'm sorry, I'm going to have to pass on over to our analyst in Europe. Teresa, how do you think this is going to play out? Is the East going to come under Russia's sphere of influence? Is it going to be annexed?
In the fog of war, no one has made any correct predictions at all in this war. And I would say that it's really unclear. No one would predict half of the things that have happened in Ukraine. So I will not make any predictions on this. They are adding more troops in the region. We know Russians have a huge morale problem, and this could, and the Ukrainians have fought very hard because it's their country and it's their land. So it's very difficult at this moment to predict what will happen. It will be a turning point, as Lavrov has stated, it's phase two. But I think that the European response to all of this needs to be more weapons, more support, more sanctions, and more money. We see Germany kind of dragging their heels on all of this. President Zelensky of Ukraine has begged for Leopard tanks from Germany. There's a lot of reluctance to do this. A new scandal just erupted recently in Europe about the SPD's ties to Gazprom, the Russian gas company. So the corruption, the octopus of Russian corruption, reaches not just to Leningrad, as everyone calls London, where it's known for washing the laundry, you know, being the laundromat for Russian oligarchs' money. But we see this in Germany, that the biggest country in Europe, the strongest economy, and they have such close ties to Russia. We see that it has hobbled any initiatives to have sanctions, meaningful sanctions on gas. Now they're trying to cobble together some sanctions on Russian oil that has been delayed for quite some time, but they're trying to iron that out. So I think that Europe really needs to take these things seriously. I know it's big and unwieldy and very hard to get these things done. They do a lot of virtue signaling and symbols, but I think that we understand that there will be spillage, that Ukraine might not just be the only, it might just be an appetizer if we look at the agreements or the draft agreements that Putin tabled back in December, that this means more than Ukraine. The Baltics are fearful. Central Eastern European member states are very fearful. So I think that Putin has inadvertently given NATO its mojo back.
Mm. But Pavel Falkenhauer, there have been war crimes documented. There has been an opening of an investigation into possible alleged war crimes. The stories, as we've been hearing for weeks now, are horrendous. These atrocities, as we've been discussing. Do you believe that Russia will, I guess, be held to account, or that these will be fully investigated?
Well, I believe they're going to be investigated, but not in Russia. Right now, Moscow is rejecting outright. No, that's a kind of traditional position. It's happened with the murder of the Polish officers in 1940, and Russia denied any responsibility till the Soviet Union collapsed together with communist rule. So I don't think right now Russia is going to cooperate Putin promised, apparently, to the Austrian chancellor that Russia would cooperate, but I don't think that that's going to happen. Of course, in the future, if there is, regime change in Moscow, these crimes could be actually tried in court, maybe even in Moscow. I don't know. But that's very much in the future. It's not immediate right now. And it doesn't have right now that much bearing on the situation in the field, though, of course, it's a terrific PR disaster for Moscow. And I believe the very serious things that have been done by Russian soldiers and apparently by their commanders were looking the other direction. I'm not sure that this was a political intent, but anyway, the result is disastrous.
Okay.
Nothing is going to be done about it anytime soon.
I'd like to come back to you, Helena Yurchenko. How do you think this is going to play out? What are your, concerns for the coming weeks and months for your country?
If Russians don't put down their weapon and leave our sovereign country, the situation not only in Ukraine, but also in the world and in Arabic world as well, will be deteriorating. The situation will be worse and worse. And there will be a very serious problem with food and with food security in Arabic world as well.
Yeah, we're already
seeing
that.
As you know, Ukraine agriculture, Ukrainian food, Ukrainian sunflower oil, but also wheat and other agricultural products are feeding Arabic world as well. 42% of Ukrainian export was agriculture and food. So if this year and next year, Arabic world will have no agriculture from Ukraine, if agricultural product will go, the price for agricultural product will go high, you know who to blame. You should blame Russia, you should blame Russian army, and you should blame Putin, because they invaded our country and they don't let us to have a proper plant or, a plant campaign.
Yeah.
We are unable to plant food for the whole world.
And I think we're already seeing that.
600 million people, 600 million people in the world are dependent on Ukrainian food.
I know, we're already seeing high price rises around the world, right? We're already seeing skyrocketing costs of basic goods for many people around the world. We're coming nearly to the end of the program. I'd like to go back to Teresa Fallon just to round out the show here. When the war first started, the Stand With Ukraine sort of symbol, it was everywhere. Do you think that as time goes on, the world's resolve, the West's resolve to help Ukraine may falter?
I mean, that's a very good question.
Yes.
You know, the international community's attention span is very limited. So I think that moves like today, President of the European Council, Charles Michel's visit to Kiev, keeps it on the map for many people. But I can see even in the news cycle, we don't see it on the front page so much anymore, the story of Ukraine. So I think the Russians understand that. And I also, we all know that the war in Donbas has been going on for 8 years. And it didn't really get onto the headlines until this recent invasion of Ukraine. So for 8 years, this has been this has been a long drawn out conflict. And so this is my concern. But on the other hand, now we're seeing, because of this kind of distraction with Ukraine, Sweden and Finland are looking like they are going to ask to join NATO. So I think that individually, Sweden and Finland, they wouldn't have considered it, but because they saw, you know, they're not really fearful of Russia so much anymore. They see the military not as frightening as they had in the past. They see it as incompetent and chaotic. And so joining together, Sweden and Finland appear to be gaining more momentum to join NATO. So there's a NATO summit in June. So this is something that will be moving forward. Mm-hmm. And today, in the Aftonbladet, it's a Swedish newspaper, there was a very positive editorial by the editorial board supporting Sweden's membership of NATO, which is really a watershed moment, because for 200 years, Sweden has been a neutral country. So for them to join with Finland, the idea that, you know, this germinating idea of joining NATO, full member status, because they do have very close cooperation with NATO at this point. But they would be covered by Article 5. So that would transform the landscape, the security landscape of Europe. And I think that Russia has really misplayed its hand. It has changed the strategic landscape of Europe in ways that they had never intended.
All right.
And I think that this is one of the effects of Ukraine.
My apologies. We have run over time. We will have to leave it there. Thank you very much for joining us, Halina Yuchenko, Pavel Falkenhauer, and Teresa Fallin. And thank you too for watching. You can see the program again anytime by visiting our website, aljazeera.com. And for further discussion, go to our Facebook page. That's facebook.com/AJInsideStory. You can also join the conversation on Twitter. Our handle is @AJInsideStory. From me, Kim Vanel, and the entire team here in Doha. Bye-bye for now.